The unsurpassed, penetrating, imperfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Thus have I heard. At one time the Blessed One was dwelling at Savatthi in Jetta's Grove, Anatha Pindika's Park. Now on that occasion, the Blessed One was instructing the monks with a Dharma talk connected with Nirvana, and those monks were receptive, intent on listening to the Dharma. Then, on realizing its significance, the Blessed One on that occasion uttered this inspired utterance. There is, monks, an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned. If, monks, there were no unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, no escape would be discerned from what is born, become, made, conditioned. But because there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, therefore there is an escape. An escape is discerned from what is born, become, made, conditioned. And that is from the Udana scripture. And that is why we train, to know our true nature, to know the unborn, to become one with the unborn. That is the great matter for which we train. Now, if you imagine nirvana as being just that state of nothingness or a void empty of self, it sounds pretty dismal. I remember when somebody was suggesting that I give up my anger and I'd feel a lot better. I thought, well, if I let go of my anger, there will just be this miserable me without the anger. and that didn't sound so great. But the Buddha is definitely saying that there is something more. And I think we've all probably experienced it to one degree or another. There is that which we long for, what Reverend Master Jiyu called the fullest emptiness you will ever know. And this is what she says in How to Grow a Lotus Blossom. To live beyond duality may seem cold to the dualistic mind. I can assure such a mind that to live beyond the opposites is anything but cold. To bathe in the Lord's fountain is to be washed thoroughly and intimately with pure love. To live beyond the opposites is to know that no matter what a being has done in the past, he or she is and always was immaculate. Living beyond the opposites eliminates the problem of labels that the world puts on others. It is knowing that he whom the world labels a criminal is immaculate in the sight of the Lord. It is knowing that she whom the world dubs a prostitute has equal rights with the Lord, with the head of the state before the Lord. They are not the Lord, and the Lord is all of them. For centuries we have usurped the Lord's prerogative, setting up our petty opinions. Still the Lord waits in all-embracing silence. Who can fathom such love? I bathed in the Lord's fountain, and I cannot even conceive of the depth of that love. I can only tell others of it and hope and pray that they may know it too before they die. So that sounds pretty good. It sounds a little better than my original view of it. So what did the Buddha say? What is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering? It is the remainderless finding and cessation of that same craving. The rejecting, relinquishing, leaving and renouncing of it. But whereon is this craving abandoned and made to cease? Wherever there is what seems lovable and gratifying, thereon it is abandoned and made to cease. This is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. This noble truth must be penetrated. This noble truth has been penetrated. And as you all know, greed, hatred, and delusion are the root of all unwholesome actions. And this is what we work on in our training, in all its aspects. They are also called the three poisons because they poison us. They poison the pure nature, our pure nature. The Buddha also called them the three fires. He said, your house is burning, burning with the three fires. The fire of passion, the fire of hate, and the fire of delusions. And the Buddha often spoke about greed, hatred, and delusion. He also talked about the three taints, which we don't often hear about. In fact, I didn't really know what they were until I started preparing for this retreat. But the Buddha was trying to help people who were interested find the complete release from suffering, the complete release from the rounds of rebirth. And so he was telling them what they needed to do in order to find what he had found. And I get the feeling from reading about when the Buddha would speak to people, and you know, 1,000 people were enlightened. You know, after that one talk, I think that at the time of the Buddha, you know, he was the only one who had found this teaching at that time. Although he did talk about there being many Buddhas before him. But I think there were people who were just really ripe for his teaching, that were in some ways like he was, really searching for something and not knowing where to look. So when he arrived and started teaching, these people were really ready to hear the teaching and really ready to put it into practice wholeheartedly. So although he taught everyone what they could understand and what would be helpful to them, he also wanted people to find what he had found, as Reverend Master Jiyu did. When you find that which is so wonderful, you want others to know it as well. So because I didn't... Well, let's see, let me backtrack. Shariputra, you know, one of his chief disciples, gave a talk to the monks on the taints, and this will tell you a little bit about them. There are these three taints: the taint of sensual desire, the taint of existence, and the taint of ignorance. With the arising of ignorance, there is the arising of the taints. With the cessation of ignorance, there is a cessation of the taints. The way leading to the cessation of the taints is just this noble eightfold path. When a noble disciple has thus understood the taints, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust, he abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion, he extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, I am. And by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. And in the end, ignorance is the root and source of our suffering. Believing there is a self, a me that needs things. Seeing things through the eyes of the self. I was once told that I was always seeing things through the eyes of my karma. So that you aren't seeing clearly because you're so affected by your karmic conditioning. And this is the house builder of this house of ego, the house of self. The self is the house builder. Now, again, since I didn't really know anything about the taints, I'm going to explain about them from what Bhikkhu Bodhi said about them. That they are the three basic defilements, and I'm not quoting him exactly, I'm paraphrasing, but they are the three basic defilements and can be thought of as almost as primordial, that which forms the foundation for this world of samsara, that which keeps us on the wheel of becoming or rebirth. The first two have a sticky quality to them. The first taint is the deep underlying tendency for sensual pleasures when the mind is stimulated by sensory impressions. These objects of the senses flow into the mind, giving rise to sensual thoughts and craving that weren't there before this happened. Then the mind gets all involved in it and goes out and seeks sensual pleasures. A person can be feeling fine, even at peace, and then she or he sees, hears, smells, or whatever, something that creates desire, which then turns to wanting and craving and needing to have it, and then seeking to have it. And then, as you know, when you can't have it, that goes to anger, or it can do. Now, I've heard an interesting story which illustrates this. And a congregation member told it to someone here. And I've told this story before, but I really like it. Where this person went out bird watching with some of his friends one day, probably to a park, a large park of some kind. And for those of you who don't bird watch, or don't know about bird watching, which I didn't, it's a very serious business if you're all involved in it. And it's very important that you find birds that you've never seen before or something that's very rare. So he went out with them, and he was, I guess they all went off looking for birds, and he was sitting on a bench. It was a nice sunny day. And he was feeling very peaceful and probably just being still, meditating. And then his friends came back to him and said, "We found this rare bird. You have to come see it." So then he got all excited about seeing this bird and really wanted to see it. And so they went chasing over to the spot where the bird had been found, and the bird had gone. So then he was completely miserable. The day had been ruined for him. But up until that point, he was completely happy. So you can see how the mind works. And because he was a trainee, you know, he could see this later and kind of laugh at it. But if, and I think this is often the way things work, you know, that we do something and we get all miserable and then we realize later what we've done. However, if you're being mindful, you can actually just notice what your mind is doing while it's happening. Seeing that you're peaceful one moment, but that's temporary. And now you're agitated. Well, that's temporary. And you don't have to get all involved in these feelings. But it's when you think that seeing the rare bird is so important to your life that you're miserable when you don't, then you suffer. When you're thinking of something outside yourself as a source of your happiness, then you suffer. And this is how ignorance leads to suffering. We think there is a me that is dependent on external things. But when we start training, we start to let that go, and we start trusting more in something deeper, and we start seeing how these pulls and how these things create suffering, and we start to let them go. The second taint is the one of existence, the deep fundamental craving for continued existence, the force that keeps us on the wheel of rebirth. We want to have a body. We want to be a self. We want to exist. Well, this seems pretty natural and normal. Who wouldn't want to exist unless your suffering is so great? This, however, is one of the last defilements to be let go of before one is enlightened. So you can see that it's very difficult to really understand why we'd want to let it go, and so difficult to let go of it. But eventually, letting go of that leads to enlightenment and leads to the complete cessation of all the suffering that we have. And boy, I think it's worth it in the end, but it's a little difficult to think of it now. And the third taint is that of ignorance, not knowing, not understanding the real nature of things. These taints, as I said, are almost primordial and more fundamental than craving, hatred, or delusion. The first two taints are aspects of craving, craving for all the sensual pleasures and craving for existence. And the third taint is the same as delusion. Ignorance is the same as delusion. But hatred or aversion isn't mentioned in the taints. And what Bhikkhu Bodhi says about this is that anger is actually not a taint because it's not something that is so fundamental as greed, as wanting to exist, as ignorance. It's something that well, I think that's about all I can say because I kind of forget what he exactly said. So the Buddha said that the way to find the complete liberation from the taints, enlightenment, one needs to do the work of restraining them. So this is our training. Now sometimes he'd talk in terms of these three very basic taints. And then sometimes he'd talk about the taints as anything that brings conflict into the mind. Turmoil, upset, displeasure, mental burning, etc. This is what we train with. Any disturbance, any feeling of conflict, those feelings are not a problem, as we've been talking about, but it's when we get all worked up by them and try to make them go away that they become a problem. It's just learning to be with whatever is arising. And if we've gotten all caught up in something and our mind is in turmoil, then it's just being with that until that goes. And sometimes we see this in advance and sometimes we don't. When we see that the mind is trying to pull us in some direction, we have the choice of going there or not. And it may seem like it would be certainly nice to go in that direction. It might bring us something. But eventually we learn that it leads nowhere. It leads to emptiness. And that it's the sitting still is what we truly long for. That's what we try. That's where we find what we truly long for. So how do we find our way out of ignorance and know the wisdom of Buddha nature? And again, it is just by doing this training. Just by observing the mind and not being fooled by all our thoughts, emotions, opinions, views, etc. The Buddha nature isn't very far away. It's right here and now. We talked last night about viewing emotions like anger and grief with compassion and learning to just be with them without judgment. One thing that I meant to mention yesterday at the talk but forgot was that what really helps with this is training with the little things that occur all day long. The little annoyances, the little frustrations, the things we think aren't important, like when your computer won't do what you want it to do. Reverend Master had this picture that she loved, which was Garfield, a cartoon character that she loved, going to a computer with a chainsaw. And the computer had like XXX all over it. And he says, "Compute this." So that kind of gives you a sense of how we feel when the computer won't do what we want. And I've been having difficulty with the printer, because the printer isn't in my room, and I'm doing these talks in my room, and then I have to print it out and go over to another office to see if it's printed. And yesterday, for some reason, I had printed out two copies of each page. And what happened was it would print out two pages, and then it would stop and it would say cleaning. And it would say cleaning for a while, and then it would say you have the wrong size paper in there or something like that. So then I'd click OK and it would print out two more pages. And then the same thing happened until I had all 8 pages, which took 8 times because I'd printed it out twice. But since I was preparing these talks, and I know about training with these little frustrations and the importance of them, I just sat with this feeling. And it was really uncomfortable, this strong frustration at my pages not coming out. And, you know, it was getting close to the Dharma talk. But I just was with it. And, you know, it probably would have been more fun to just get annoyed or to stomp up and down, but I didn't. So the feeling eventually went, and that's what happens. So if we can learn how to train with the little things and not see them as unimportant, then when the bigger things come, it'll be a lot easier to deal with them. Because when we train with the little things, we are starting to open our hearts to the unborn, to those moments of peacefulness, to something deeper. We are saying the anger, the frustration isn't the reality. There's something deeper, and I'm willing to sit within that. It's our faith. So when the harder things arise, as we were talking about last night, you know, the strong anger or the deep grief, will already be kind of rooted in that faith of the unborn, the faith of our Buddha nature. And so we'll have more of a faith that we can sit with what may be very difficult. And another aspect of this is not allowing feelings in, which I have noticed within myself. Something that I know is going to create anger in me. Something that makes me angry. Okay, it's me getting angry. It's not really the thing making me angry, but that something that I get angry about. I don't want to be angry. I want to be a nice person. I want to get along with the other person. And so I don't allow anger in. And it builds up and builds up until finally I burst with anger. And then it's very painful. And then you have to apologize. And then you feel the suffering of what you've done. And then you think, I can never control my anger. So it's a whole thing. But when you let it in, when you allow those really uncomfortable feelings of anger or grief or hurt, whatever it is, when you let it in, then you're less likely, with awareness, you know, with mindfulness, seeing that this is going on, then you're less likely to actually suddenly burst into anger and not know where it came from. So it's the awareness and allowing things in that really helps. And as we do this practice, we do start to see how greed and anger lead to suffering. And sometimes it's immediate. Delusion can be a little bit harder to understand and see, but in thinking about delusion, I see it as believing in our karmic views about things, in all our conditioning, which I've talked about, and what the self is telling us, all our ideas and opinions and views about life. That's why it's so helpful to let, you know, we all have lots of ideas and opinions, but to let them come and go and not be so attached to them, because they're often wrong, I found for myself anyway, and they can lead to suffering if we hold on to them. And so believing in all this, I would say, is delusion. And then acting from it creates suffering. And maybe when you act on something you believe in, you can't understand why it leads to suffering. So that's why we meditate. And that's why we're mindful. And that's why we're willing to look at ourselves, even though it may be uncomfortable. Well, what happens when we don't act on greed, anger, and delusion? Then we have a little bit, then we know a little bit of the peace of nirvana. When we give in to these pulls, then we see the suffering. When we allow things in and refrain, then we see, at least for that moment, the cessation of suffering. And the more we train, the more we realize the cessation of suffering. And also the more we are aware of the true nature working within us, the more we can listen to the still small voice within, the more we can act from that and not act from greed, hatred, and delusion. One thing I've also noticed in my own training is that the more my faith grows, the more difficult things I am shown. So it doesn't necessarily get any easier or get less painful, for me anyway. Although the moments of peace and joy are there as well. And I know that allowing these things in is the right thing to do, and that it is helping me to cleanse my karma. And another aspect of what this training does for us, and what is so important and so helpful, is that we know within that we are doing the right thing, or at least the right thing for us. We know that we're on the path, that we are gradually opening to what is real and true. And we can be content with that and not be waiting for some enlightenment in the future when we've let go of everything. And as you can, let go. As you see the opportunity, let go. And Ajahn Munindo said that often people don't understand what letting go means. So why don't you look at where you're holding on? I see letting go as allowing things in, not holding on to them, and allowing them to go when they go of their own. But if you can't, if something is difficult to let go of, look at why you're holding on. That might be a way to go. Ajahn Chah said, if you let go a little, you will have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you will have a lot of peace. And if you let go completely, now I can't remember what he said at that point. It was something great, but I didn't have time this morning to go through all my books to look it up, so I can leave you to fill in the blank there. I'd like to read something from the island. Okay. There is the sudden and gradual path to enlightenment. Nirvana, like all of the Dharma, is directly visible, immediate, to be personally experienced by the wise. So this is a story of the Buddha. Once the Brahmin, Janusoni, approached the Blessed One and spoke to him thus, it is said, Master Gotama, Nirvana is directly visible. In what way, Master Gotama, is Nirvana directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, worthy of application, to be personally experienced by the wise? When, Brahman, a person is impassioned with lust, depraved through hatred, bewildered through delusion, overwhelmed and infatuated by delusion, then he plans for his own harm, for the harm of others, for the harm of both. And he experiences in his mind suffering and grief. But when lust, hatred, and delusion have been abandoned, he neither plans for his own harm, nor for the harm of others, nor for the harm of both, and he does not experience in his mind suffering and grief. In this way, Brahman, is Nirvana directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, worthy of application, to be personally experienced by the wise. And I think in the moments where you don't give in to greed, hate, and delusion, then you experience a bit of this nirvana. We talked a lot about anger at our discussion last night. And I think we came up with some good things about it. There is one thing that Ajahn Chah talked about in his book, The Four Noble Truths, in the section on the Third Noble Truth, which also talks about anger and cessation. So I'd like to read you that. Cessation is easy to understand on an intellectual level, but to realize it may be quite difficult because this entails abiding with what we think we cannot bear. For example, when I first started meditating, I had the idea that meditation would make me kinder and happier, and I was expecting to experience blissful mind states. But during the first 2 months, I never felt so much hatred and anger in my life. I thought, this is terrible. Meditation has made me worse. But then I contemplated why there was so much hatred and aversion coming up. And I realized that much of my life had been an attempt to run away from all that. I used to be a compulsive reader. I would have to take books with me wherever I went. Anytime fear or aversion started creeping in, I would whip out my book and read, or I would smoke or munch on snacks. I had an image of myself as being a kind person that did not hate people, so any hint of aversion or hatred was repressed. This was why, during the first few months as a monk, I was so desperate for things to do. I was trying to seek something to distract myself with because I had started to remember in meditation all the things I deliberately tried to forget. Memories from childhood and adolescence kept coming up in my mind. Then this anger and hatred became so conscious, it just seemed to overwhelm me. But something in me began to recognize that I had to bear with this. So I did stick it out. All the hatred and anger that had been suppressed in 30 years of living rose to its peak at this time, and it burned itself out and ceased through meditation. It was a process of purification. We have to open our minds to suffering, because it is in embracing suffering that suffering ceases. And as you can see, I like to quote from Ajahn Sumedho, and it's because he talks so openly about his own humanity and his own struggles. It makes training seem so possible, no matter who we are, no matter what difficulties we may have. And I've also found in my own training that what may seem impossible for me now, with continued training, becomes possible in the future. And I have experienced this, thinking, I just can't possibly do that. And then sometime down the line, oh, I can do that. So don't think anything's impossible. Ajahn Chah said, "The Buddha mind is free, brilliantly radiant, and unentangled, without any problems or issues. The reasons problems arise is because the mind is deluded by conditioned things, this misconception of self." On the night of his enlightenment, the Buddha penetrated the three knowledges, which I spoke of earlier. He knew the bliss of release. And he also awakened to the unconditioned, unborn, undying, unchanging nirvana. And this is the most important aspect of his awakening. He didn't seem to talk about it that much, this most important thing, because he wanted, I guess because he wanted people to do the practice, to not get sidetracked. But he did talk about it from time to time, and Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro made an anthology of the Buddha's teachings on nirvana in their book, The Island, to let people know what he did say. And as you know, there are several copies up there in the guest house, and also I've been quoting from it. After his enlightenment, the Buddha spent the next 49 days in meditation, experiencing the bliss of release and reviewing the implications of the insights that had brought about his awakening. The whole of the Dharma world was open to him, and he explored it. He wasn't a person who became wise. There was no Gotama. The self had been totally abandoned by him. He was one with the wisdom of the universe. He was one with the wisdom of all the Buddhas. While singing the scripture of great wisdom one morning while I was at the hermitage preparing for this retreat, these lines jumped out at me. "And going on beyond this human mind, he is nirvana. All the Buddhas true of present, past, and future, they are all. Because upon great wisdom they rely, the perfect and most high enlightenment." And now some quotes from the Buddha. "It is the unformed, the unconditioned, the end, the truth, the other shore, the subtle, the everlasting, the invisible, the undiversified, peace, the deathless, the blessed, safety, the wonderful, the marvelous, nirvana, purity, freedom, the island, the refuge, the beyond. Having nothing, clinging to nothing, that is the island. There is no other. That is nirvana. I tell you, the total ending of aging and death." "There is an island which you cannot go beyond. It is a place of nothingness, a place of non-possession and of non-attachment. It is the total end of death and decay. This is why I call it nirvana." And now a quote from Upasika Ki Nanoyan. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. "An inward staying, unentangled knowing, all outward going knowing, cast aside." have too many quotes that I want to tell you, and it's getting almost to 10:30, but I'm going to read a couple at any rate. These come from Reverend Master Jiu. And this is in Roar of the Tigress, in the volume 2 in The Great Ocean of Meditation. It's very humbling to realize how, where does she start? Viewing the arising and vanishing of the elements from the place of meditation makes it possible to go onward, not only through the fears that arise from attachment, but also through the grief that arises in this sad world. Indeed, sometimes the world is cruel and unfair. Sometimes it's downright terrible. These things are explained by the law of karma. Karma is cold comfort. I know, I've had to live with it. But if one stays still in meditation, gradually one sees over the years that the essence is the supreme thing, that our little judgments and our little opinions do not really amount to much as one hair on a dog's back. It's very humbling to realize how great the design of the universe is, because it is not fully comprehensible by any of us. But one can have some glimpse of the colossal size of it and how important and benevolent it actually is. Yes, all the suffering does go on an individual level, or so it seems. And so long as our faith stays true, we can help that suffering by staying within the third position, within meditation. That does not mean that we become cold-hearted. It doesn't mean that we become non-compassionate. It doesn't mean we can't grieve. The Zen master can both grieve and cry, but his grief does not overwhelm him or her, so that he is incapable of acting, because he himself or she is rooted in faith and meditation. And the same can be true of every monk and every lay person. If you are rooted in faith and living in the third position, then when the horrors of stupidity and ignorance come, you will not be overwhelmed by the suffering. Instead, you will want to renew your own efforts, both in helping and strengthening your own faith and in helping and strengthening the faith of others. If your faith is rooted in this place, in the living meditative state that bears the seal of the ocean, then although there will be grief, although there will be pain, it will be bearable, and we will not be so caught up in the emotionalism of the moment that we do not know what to do to alleviate the pain of self and others. We will, in fact, because we are not caught up in that emotionalism, be the most effective people possible. You must accept that, whilst we remain in this body, within this body, whilst the elements coalesce together, life will be painful. What we need to know is that we can sit still beneath it. The Zen master does not offer you magic that will turn off the pain of the world. He or she does show you how you can sit still beneath that pain so that you can help the world to make itself less painful. It's very hard work, and that's how it's done, by sitting still in the place of meditation and allowing the essence to flow through you. And then one quick thing at the end of this chapter. Every time you sit down to meditate, you are beckoning to the great ocean of meditation. It is because every time you sit down to meditate, the great ocean is beckoning to you. It is because every time you sit down to meditate, you are all, blindly and unknowingly, aswim within the great ocean of meditation. Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.